paramedics arrived just after sunrise. The small apartment was still quiet, the kind of quiet that feels wrong. 5-year-old Elijah De La Cruz lay on the living room floor while his mother's boyfriend stood nearby, shifting from foot to foot, repeating the same line about a fall. The first responders had seen falls. This was not a fall. What they saw raised questions before anyone said a word, bruising in different stages, marks that did not line up with the story. A child who should have been getting ready for school was instead fighting for his life as they rushed him to the hospital. By midday, Elijah was gone. Detectives began interviewing the adults, splitting them into separate rooms. The stories did not match. Medical staff noted injuries that hinted at something deeper and older. And in the hours that followed, a larger question took shape, one that swept far beyond the apartment's walls. How many warnings had been ignored before this morning? Chapter 1: The Day Everything Broke. The morning of Elijah's final day started like any other in the neighborhood on the east side of Colorado Springs. The winter air was sharp, the sky a pale blue, and small patches of snow still clung to corners of the sidewalk. Inside the apartment, though, the calm outside did not match what first responders walked into after the 911 call came in at around 7 in the morning. The call had been brief. The mother's boyfriend said the boy had fallen. He sounded tense, breath fast, words uneven. The dispatcher noted the tone, but followed protocol, sending the closest unit. The call was coded as an unresponsive child with possible trauma, the kind of call that made medics move faster than usual. When the paramedics stepped through the doorway, they felt it immediately, the shift in the room that seasoned responders notice before their eyes settle on details. Elijah lay on the carpeted floor of the living room. He was small, 5 years old, slight, still in his pajamas. His skin was pale. His chest rose in uneven attempts at breath. The medics dropped to their knees beside him and started the assessment. The boyfriend stood near the hallway, arms folded tight across his chest. His eyes tracked the medics, but he did not move closer. One medic asked him what happened. He repeated the same line. Elijah fell. She asked how far. He said from standing. She asked when. He paused, then gave a time that didn't match Elijah's current condition. The medic did not challenge him. She simply turned back to the child and continued her work. As they lifted Elijah onto the gurney, the medic closest to his torso noticed bruising on the child's abdomen. Some marks were fresh, others were older. She said nothing yet. They were trained to keep thoughts to themselves until after stabilization. The mother was not home. She had left earlier for work. Another medic asked the boyfriend where she was. He gave a short answer and looked at the floor. It was enough to know she was not present when Elijah collapsed. The ambulance doors closed and they moved. Elijah's breathing was failing. On the way to the hospital, one medic tried again to get information. Kids fall all the time. Bruises happen. But the injuries on Elijah's body did not look like the kind that come from one moment or one misstep. The boyfriend repeated the same answer, voice sharper this time. He said Elijah had fallen the night before, and again that morning. The medic pressed once more for clarity. He cut the conversation short and stared out the window. When they arrived at the hospital, the trauma team was already waiting. The lead physician moved in with a firm voice and clear steps. They checked vitals, ran scans, pushed fluids, and attempted to stabilize him. The marks on Elijah's torso and legs now had the full attention of the medical staff. They noted the patterned bruising. They noted the swelling. They noted a timeline that made no medical sense. At 8:30 a.m., despite every attempt, Elijah did not respond. The room went quiet as the attending doctor called time of death. Nurses lowered their heads. One placed a hand over her face. Moments with children stayed with them longer than others. Law enforcement had already been notified because of the nature of the injuries. When the detective on duty arrived, he asked to speak with the physician in charge. She gave a summary of the medical findings. She chose her words carefully. She did not assert cause. She described what she saw. Injuries in different stages of healing. Evidence of impact not consistent with a simple fall. Internal trauma that indicated severe force. The detective nodded. He'd heard enough to know this was not routine. Two officers escorted the boyfriend to a quiet room for questioning. They began with open-ended questions. He held to his story, but details shifted. First, he said, Elijah fell once. Then he said twice. He could not explain the timing of the bruises. When officers asked him to clarify how a standing fall could cause such extensive injuries, he said Elijah bruised easily. He crossed his arms. His eyes darted toward the door. The detectives kept their voices level. They did not accuse. They gathered his statements, careful to document everything. Another team arrived at the apartment to secure the scene. Inside, they photographed the living room. They looked for objects that could cause injuries. They found none that matched the medical patterns. A small plastic toy truck lay on its side. A spill of crayons marked the corner, stuck under a shelf. Nothing pointed to an accident severe enough to match Elijah's condition. The mother returned from work late in the morning. Officers met her outside and explained that Elijah was gone. Her legs buckled. She cried out with a pain that cut through the cold air. She asked what happened. The officers did not have an answer. They told her what the medics saw. They told her the medical team had questions about the explanation they were given. She covered her face with both hands and shook with grief. Back at the station, detectives reviewed the first reports from the medics and the hospital. The photographs from the early responsive team made one thing clear: this was not a single event injury. They listed each observation: abdominal trauma, bruising on the back, marks that suggested pressure, possible older injuries that required further forensic review. They requested the medical examiner's involvement immediately. In the early afternoon, the medical examiner conducted the initial assessment. She noted blunt force trauma. She noted internal injuries inconsistent with the explanation provided. She marked injuries that indicated previous harm. These findings were preliminary, but they shaped the direction of the investigation. Detectives spoke again with the mother. She told them Elijah had been quiet the past week. He had complained of stomach pain. He had seemed tired. She thought he had a flu or something similar. She said she never saw him fall in a way that explained what she now knew. She looked lost, as though the ground beneath her had shifted into something she no longer recognized. The officers asked her about her boyfriend. She explained their relationship. She described him as strict, but said she did not believe he would hurt Elijah. They asked if there had been arguments or tension. She hesitated. She said there were times he got frustrated. They asked if Elijah ever mentioned feeling scared. She looked down at her hands and said she didn't know. In the late afternoon, detectives interviewed neighbors. One neighbor recalled hearing loud arguments from the apartment recently. Another said she had seen Elijah with noticeable bruises weeks earlier. When asked if she had reported anything, she said no. She thought it wasn't her place. She assumed children fall. She said she felt sick when she realized what she had seen might have been a sign. By the end of the day, the investigation had shifted from a question of what happened to a search for how long it had been happening. Detectives reviewed reports from local law enforcement. They checked prior calls connected to the address. Any history, arguments, welfare checks, domestic violence calls, would shape the path forward. They submitted requests for digital records and text messages between the adults in the home. By nightfall, the detective leading the case sat alone at his desk. He reviewed the notes again, the timeline from the morning, the initial medical findings, the conflicting statements. He wrote a question at the top of the page. It was the question that would define the direction of the entire investigation. How did no one intervene sooner? He stared at the page, knowing the answer would not be simple and would not be contained in a single report. It would stretch back through days, weeks, and possibly months. It would point toward a system designed to protect children, yet still capable of missing danger until it was too late. Elijah's final day had begun with a nervous voice on a 911 call. It ended with a community asking how far back the failures went. And in the space between those two moments, a truth began to settle in. This was not just a tragedy inside one apartment. This was the beginning of a larger reckoning. Chapter 2: The Warnings No One Stopped to Hear. By the morning after Elijah's death, detectives had shifted from the immediate shock of the scene to the deeper question that had surfaced again and again during early interviews. How long had danger been building inside the home? It was not enough to understand the final 24 hours. To answer the central question of the case, they needed to move backward through every warning, every report, every clue that might explain why a 5-year-old boy had been left without protection. The lead detective started with the basics. He gathered Elijah's school records, medical records, and any documented interactions between the household and city or county agencies. He moved deliberately, creating a timeline that began months before the morning Elijah was found unresponsive. Nothing was assumed. Each entry in the timeline required a confirmed source. The early entries focused on Elijah's daily life. He was a small child with a quiet nature. Teachers described him as gentle, polite, and sometimes shy. He liked drawing. He responded well to encouragement. One teacher wrote that he had a bright smile when he felt safe. But several notes in his file stood out even before detectives read the full statements. There were mentions of fatigue, moments where he seemed withdrawn, and a few instances where staff noticed bruising. Some comments were brief, simple observations that staff believed had innocent explanations at the time. Others suggested concern, but not enough to trigger mandatory action. Elijah was a 5-year-old. Children fall. Children play rough. Teachers are careful not to assume the worst, but those small notes would become weightier as the full timeline took shape. Across town, investigators visited relatives who had regular contact with the family. One aunt remembered seeing Elijah with faint marks on his arms in the autumn of 2022. She said she asked about them, and the mother told her he had been clumsy, that he tripped often. The aunt said she accepted the answer because nothing else seemed wrong at the time. She said Elijah seemed tired sometimes when he visited, but still played when encouraged. The detectives documented the statement. They did not attach judgment. They simply added it to the growing line of moments where something may have been seen, but not fully understood. The next part of the timeline involved law enforcement contacts. Detectives checked system logs. They found a domestic disturbance call linked to the adults in the home from months earlier. The call had not involved Elijah directly. It was classified as a verbal dispute between adults. Officers had responded, separated the parties, resolved the moment, and left. There was no evidence of physical harm reported during that call. But domestic disturbance histories often provide critical context in child injury investigations. Detectives added the incident to the timeline. They reviewed the responding officer's body camera notes for tone, behavior, and observations of the environment. Nothing in that call had triggered a deeper welfare check at the time. Digging deeper, detectives reviewed medical history entries. Multiple pediatric visits occurred during the year before Elijah's death. Most were normal. A few involved minor complaints like colds and stomach discomfort. Nothing in those visits suggested immediate danger. But one visit, months earlier, noted mild bruising along Elijah's side. The physician's note said the injuries were explained by playtime roughhousing. The note did not indicate concern for abuse. There were no additional follow-up requirements. It was the type of entry that seemed routine when read alone. But in the evolving timeline, it added another thread, another moment where injury was noticed but not flagged. Investigators next turned to neighbors. They revisited the apartment complex to interview more tenants. One neighbor on the first floor said she often heard footsteps and normal household sounds. She had no concerns. Another neighbor, who lived directly below Elijah's apartment, recalled hearing occasional thuds or loud movements during the fall and winter. She said she assumed it was normal for a home with a young child. When asked whether she heard yelling or distress, she hesitated. She said yes, there were times she heard raised voices. She said she thought adults were arguing. She admitted she did not report anything. She said she did not know it was serious. She said the weight of that realization was now heavy. Detectives kept pressing through the timeline. They reviewed text messages between the adults in the household. This required legal steps, but the request was approved. When the reports came in, investigators found arguments, moments of tension, and exchanges about discipline. None of the messages contained a direct admission of harm to Elijah. There were statements that suggested frustration. There were exchanges where the boyfriend described Elijah as acting out. Detectives examined the wording closely. They compared the tone to the timeline of events leading to the boy's death. No single message provided proof of abuse. But combined with everything else, the messages painted a picture of a home stressed by conflict. In the afternoon, detectives interviewed the mother again. This interview was longer and more detailed. They walked through the timeline with her, asking about each moment. She was emotional. She answered as clearly as she could. She said she never saw the boyfriend strike Elijah. She said she believed the discipline in the home was strict, but not violent. Detectives asked whether she ever noticed injuries on her son. She lowered her head and said yes, sometimes. She said he bruised easily. She said she had asked him what happened, but he would say he fell or bumped into something. She said she wanted to believe those explanations. She said she felt overwhelmed at times. They asked whether she ever questioned the boyfriend about the marks. She nodded slowly. She said he told her the boy needed to listen better and that accidents happen. She said she accepted that at the time. The detectives documented every word. They noted her emotional responses. They noted the difficulty she had recalling certain periods. They noted the weight of hindsight. But they kept the questions grounded in facts. They did not press speculation. They did not challenge her grief. They remained focused on the timeline. Later that day, investigators visited the school again. A staff member recalled Elijah coming in one morning looking unusually tired. She said he moved slowly during playtime. She said she asked him if he was okay, and he said he was. She said she remembered a small bruise on his arm at the time. She said she thought nothing of it, because children often have marks. She said she now wondered if she should have asked more questions. Detectives made a note. They did not assign fault. They did not judge her memory. They simply added the detail to the timeline. Another staff member remembered Elijah saying he missed his mother often. She said he spoke of wanting to be with her more. The statement was emotional, not necessarily evidence. But emotional context often shapes understanding in these cases. Detectives included the observation in the timeline, but marked it as background only. From there, the investigation shifted toward the state's Child Protection Agency. Detectives requested records to confirm whether any welfare reports had ever been connected to the household. The request took time, but once received, it added more complexity to the case. There was at least one previous report. It involved concerns about the home environment. According to the record, a caseworker had visited the residence months earlier. After the visit, the case was closed with a note stating that the child appeared safe and that no further action was required at the time. Detectives reviewed the caseworker's documentation. It indicated the child was quiet but responsive. It noted the home was tidy. It mentioned no observable injuries. Without visible danger or clear signs of abuse, the agency did not escalate the case. That decision now stood at the center of difficult public conversations. Detectives interviewed the caseworker. She explained the reasoning behind her decision. She said Elijah did not show distress during the visit. She said the adults appeared calm. She said she saw no injuries. She said she had no authority to pursue further involvement without evidence. She said she carried many cases at once. She said she thought of Elijah often after learning of his death. She said she wished something more had been visible. Detectives documented her statement. They respected the emotional weight of her position. They kept the tone factual and neutral. At the same time, investigators were reviewing information collected from the medical examiner's preliminary findings. The examiner had identified evidence of previous injuries. Some marks were weeks old. Some showed healing at different rates. These findings suggested that Elijah had experienced harm before the final day. But the medical examiner noted that not all injuries indicate abuse. Some could have occurred accidentally. Some could be explained by childhood play. Others, however, raised serious questions. The medical examiner emphasized that the full forensic report would be needed to determine the final conclusions. Detectives continued gathering statements from people who knew the family. A family friend said she had noticed Elijah seemed subdued in recent months. She said he clung to his mother more. She said he appeared anxious at times. She said she did not witness abuse. She said she simply felt something was off. She said she did not know how to name it at the time. Another friend said she saw the boyfriend become frustrated easily. She said he had a temper. She said she did not believe he would intentionally harm a child, but acknowledged she had seen moments of anger that concerned her. She said she regretted not pressing the mother to seek help or support. Detectives collected her statement and added it to the timeline. The deeper investigators went, the more the timeline expanded with moments of potential concern. A quiet bruise, a tired morning, a stressed adult, a welfare check that found nothing immediately alarming. None of these moments alone proved the danger Elijah was in. But together, they drew a picture of a child whose warning signs were scattered across different hands, different agencies, different days, never fully connected. Detectives held daily briefings, reviewing the timeline again and again. They questioned each entry. They challenged each assumption. They asked whether any moment should have triggered more than it did. But their job was not to assign blame at this stage. Their task was to understand the truth of what had happened. As they examined the gathered evidence, they saw that the final day had not emerged from nowhere. It had roots that ran deeper than anyone wanted to admit. The detectives understood this pattern. They had seen similar cases before. Not every warning is recognized. Not every bruise is reported. Not every moment raises enough alarm to shift action. Systems designed to protect children often rely on visibility, on signs that can be measured or confirmed. When signs are subtle or spread across time, they become harder to act upon, harder to see for what they are. But the detectives also understood that some warnings had been clearer than others. The domestic disturbance history, the previous welfare check, the pattern of injuries identified by the medical examiner. These elements formed the backbone of the case. They shaped the next steps. They provided the necessary foundation for the decisions that would follow once forensic findings were complete. By the close of the week, the timeline covered months of Elijah's life. It held every known moment of concern, every documented bruise, every call, every visit, every interview. It was incomplete, as all timelines are, because it could not capture everything the child had felt. But it was thorough. It was grounded. It was factual. In the final briefing of the day, the detective stood over the timeline and looked at the notes. He saw the first warnings appear months earlier. He saw the progression. He saw the gaps. He saw the moments when fear, stress, or uncertainty prevented someone from speaking or acting. He saw the moments when the system did not have enough information to move forward. And he saw the morning when everything finally broke. He placed a single line at the bottom of the chart. Where did the system fail and when? It was the question that would guide the next phase of the investigation. It was the question that would lead directly to the break in the case, the charges, the public response, and the review that would soon follow. And it was the question that made one thing painfully clear. The signs were there, scattered across time, waiting to be seen. Chapter 3, The Break, The Charges, and the Cost. The breakthrough in Elijah's case did not come from a single moment. It was the result of threads pulled together across days of careful work. Each detail added to an expanding picture that pointed toward one conclusion. But before detectives reached that point, they needed the final piece, the medical examiner's full report. The report arrived late in the week. It was detailed, clinical, and written with the precision that cases like this required. It confirmed what first responders and doctors had suspected from the early moments in the emergency room. Elijah's injuries were not consistent with a simple fall. The report identified blunt force trauma to the abdomen as the immediate cause of death. It noted internal bleeding, swelling, and tissue damage. It documented injuries in various stages of healing, suggesting previous harm. The language was careful. It described patterns. It did not assign intent. But the implications were clear. The lead detective read the findings twice. He underlined key phrases. He took a long breath and closed the folder. The final facts gave the investigation its turning point. There was now enough evidence to confront the inconsistencies from earlier interviews. Detectives returned to the boyfriend for a follow-up interrogation. This time, they entered with the medical examiner's conclusions in hand. The room was quiet. The boyfriend sat across the table with his arms crossed. The lead detective began by reviewing the injuries. He spoke slowly, letting each detail settle, He described the depth of the trauma. He explained that the report disproved any explanation involving a simple fall. He asked for clarification. The boyfriend insisted the fall happened. He said Elijah had been clumsy. He said he did not know why the boy was injured. The detectives pressed for a timeline. They asked him to retrace every part of the morning. They asked what he did when Elijah collapsed. They asked why he delayed calling 911, a delay noted by the timestamps on his phone. He said he panicked. He said he tried to wake the child. He said he didn't know how long he waited. The detectives noted each answer. They did not raise their voices. They kept the tone steady and factual. As the interview continued, detectives showed him photographs. They displayed images taken by the medical team and the responsive officers. They pointed out injuries that could not have occurred from the explanation he repeated. The boyfriend became defensive. He said he did not know how the injuries happened. He said he did not strike the child. He said he did not intend harm. His answers came faster. His posture tightened. His voice rose, then dropped. He looked at the wall, then back at the table. The detectives ended the session. They had enough. The inconsistencies were clear. The medical evidence contradicted the explanation offered. The broader timeline supported suspicion rather than innocence. They moved forward with the next step. Preparation for arrest. Later that day, detectives met with the district attorney's office. They presented the findings. They laid out the timeline, the medical report, the witness statements, and the inconsistencies documented in interviews. Prosecutors reviewed everything. They asked about prior calls to the home. They asked about any known domestic incidents. They asked about the welfare check months earlier. The detectives answered each question with verified details. The prosecutors agreed the evidence supported charges. They drafted the paperwork. The language was exact. The charges were based on the injuries, the timeline, and the medical examiner's report. Allegations were labeled clearly. Nothing beyond the proven facts was included. The district attorney reviewed the final version and approved it. It was time to make the arrest. Detectives located the boyfriend at a relative's home. He did not resist. Officers placed him in handcuffs and read him his rights. Neighbors watched quietly from their porches. Some shook their heads, some whispered. A few held their children closer. The weight of the moment settled across the small community. At the station, he was processed and placed in a holding room. Prosecutors finalized the announcement. Local news outlets received verified information once the arrest became public record. The coverage reflected the seriousness of the case. The age of the victim, the medical findings, the charges filed, the grief of the community, the questions about system failures. Reporters were careful. They labeled allegations as such. They did not speculate. They did not sensationalize. They focused on the facts as they unfolded. Meanwhile, Elijah's family prepared for his funeral. The community stepped in to support them. Local organizations offered help. Teachers from his school shared memories of the boy who smiled softly when praised for his drawings. Family members spoke of his quiet nature and the moments when he laughed with his cousins during small gatherings. These were not public statements. They were private reflections shared in quiet rooms, spoken through tears. Across the state, conversations began about child protection systems. Officials reviewed prior cases. Policy advocates spoke about the challenges faced by agencies handling high caseloads. Some pointed to resource shortages. Others pointed to gaps in communication between schools, medical offices, and child welfare workers. Some questioned whether the welfare check conducted months earlier should have been handled differently. Caseworkers spoke about the difficulty of identifying hidden abuse when signs are subtle. Experts reminded the public that hindsight often clarifies what was not obvious in the moment. But the case also highlighted the national problem of uneven intervention thresholds. Child welfare systems rely on visible signs, clear evidence, or strong disclosures. When danger is hidden behind closed doors, when adults mask conflict, when children are too young to speak for themselves, and when injuries appear mild or explainable, the system often lacks the tools to act. The complexity of these cases is not a shield from responsibility, but it is a reminder of the limits faced by agencies tasked with protection. In the days after the arrest, detectives worked on finalizing the case file. They organized every piece of evidence. They reviewed the medical report again. They re-verified each witness statement. They prepared their summaries for the district attorney. They wanted the case to be strong, clear, and grounded in facts. There was no room for gaps. There was no allowance for assumptions. The case involved a child, and the investigators approached it with the full weight of that responsibility. The mother, coping with grief and shock, continued to cooperate with investigators. She answered additional questions. She reviewed parts of the timeline. She acknowledged moments where she had seen small signs but had not understood their meaning. She spoke about the pressures she felt, the financial strain, the emotional weight of parenting, and the desire to believe the best about the people in her home. Detectives documented her statements carefully, ensuring nothing was misrepresented or distorted. As the case moved forward, community leaders held meetings to address broader concerns. The focus was not only on Elijah's tragedy, but also on preventing future failures. Social workers, educators, and law enforcement officials discussed ways to improve communication and early intervention. They looked at training, reporting protocols, and collaboration structures. The discussions were measured and respectful. Their aim was clarity, not blame. When the county released a general statement regarding the case, they expressed condolences to the family and reaffirmed their commitment to reviewing all procedures connected to child safety. They could not discuss specifics because of confidentiality laws, but they acknowledged the need for transparency and accountability where appropriate. The statement did not satisfy everyone, but it set the stage for ongoing review. On the legal side, the next phase moved steadily. The boyfriend appeared in court for an initial hearing. Prosecutors summarized the medical findings and the investigation's foundation. The judge reviewed the charges and set conditions for the next hearing. The public listened with a mix of sorrow and frustration. The details were heavy. The loss was immeasurable. Throughout the legal process, detectives stayed in close contact with the district attorney's team. They clarified details, provided follow-up documentation, and prepared their testimony. They approached each step with care, ensuring their statements would be factual, consistent, and grounded in the evidence collected. As the case gained public attention, policymakers spoke more openly about the pressures placed on child protection systems. They discussed the need for better staffing, better training, and better risk assessment tools. They acknowledged the gaps that can occur when information is scattered across schools, medical offices, law enforcement agencies, and welfare departments. They emphasized the need for stronger communication links. Some discussions pointed toward legislative changes. Others focused on improving local processes. In private, detectives continued to revisit the timeline they had spent days assembling. They reviewed every warning that had surfaced in Chapter 2 of their work. They looked at the welfare check that had shown no injuries at the time. They looked at the domestic disturbance call months earlier. They looked at the minor injuries noted by medical staff. They looked at the observations made by teachers. They saw the pattern clearly now. But they also saw how each moment, standing alone, had lacked the conclusive evidence necessary for intervention. It was the intersection of those moments, the way they converged, that painted the truth. And that convergence had only become visible after it was too late. Toward the end of the month, the lead detective stood again over the timeline pinned to the board. He read through each entry slowly. The weight of the case settled into him. He saw the small notes that had once seemed unremarkable. He saw the intersections of stress, misunderstanding, and silence. He saw the structural limits of systems built to protect children, but constrained by visibility and authority. He saw the ways in which danger often hides until a breaking point forces truth to the surface. He added one final line to the bottom of the board. What must change to keep the next child safe? It was not a question for the case file. It was a question for the community, the state, and everyone connected to child welfare. It was the question that would live beyond the legal process, beyond the courtroom, beyond the reports and briefings. Elijah's story did not end with his final mourning. It continued in the conversations his case sparked, the reforms being considered, and the renewed attention to early warning signs. The cost of missed signals was now painfully clear. And in the quiet spaces of the county, where those who knew him grieved, there was a shared hope that his life, even in tragedy, would lead to stronger protections for children whose voices are too small to be heard on their own.